Welcome to Navigating Marine Risks, a podcast series produced in partnership with AIG, featuring panel discussions with leading marine industry experts. Our series host is Dr. Stavros Karamparidis, head of the Maritime Transport Research Group at the University of Plymouth, UK. Joining Stavros to discuss the impact of rising sea levels to port infrastructure are Lydia Vamvakeradu Larudia, Watershare Program Director, KWR Water Research, the Netherlands, and Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Water Systems, University of Exeter, UK. Heather Houston, Royal Heskoning DHV, and Chair PIANC, the World Association for Waterborne Transport Infrastructure, UK. And Regina Asariotis, Chief Policy and Legislation Section, Division on Technology and Logistics, United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, Switzerland.
Welcome to Navigating Marine Risks, produced in partnership with AIG. I'm your host, Dr. Stavros Karamparidis. With the impact of the global pandemic, the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine, and the Red Sea attacks, new terms such as nearshoring and friendly shoring arise to describe what is happening to the global economy and supply chains. Those terms reflect the significant economic uncertainty around the globe and the tectonic changes that globalization is facing. Because the maritime transport sector carries 80% of the global trade, those trends and events are heavily impacting it. At the same time, rising sea levels and their effect on port infrastructure is an increasingly important point for consideration and for future-proofing ports operations. As the frequency of the extreme weather phenomena has increased, as an outcome of climate change. In this episode, we will be discussing the impact of the rising sea levels on the global port sector, shipping and trade. Thank you for joining with me today, Lydia, Heather, and Regina, and welcome to all. Regina, could you share with us some thoughts on the importance of ports for sustainable transport, trade and development, and why the need for climate change adaptation and disaster resilience is becoming increasingly urgent?
Thank you very much, Stavros, and it's a pleasure to be here. This is a set of issues we've been working on for many years, since 2008, including collaboration with many international regional organizations, experts, industry, and we've been highlighting as part of our work. There are two sides to the climate change coin, both of which need to be addressed. And these are the impacts of transport on climate change and the need for mitigation, but also the impacts of climate change on transport and the need for adaptation, which is often forgotten. And you've already mentioned, with over 80% of the volume of world trade carried by sea, ports are absolutely vital for global trade and for sustainable development. They're actually key nodes in the network of closely interlinked global supply chains. And you could say they're gateways to global markets for all countries and also for access to blue economy sectors. For some of the smaller developing countries, in particular the small island developing states, they're actual lifelines because they're entirely dependent for trade, food and energy security, tourism, and in the context of DRR on their ports. But at the same time, these critical infrastructure assets, they're also at considerable risk of climate change impacts. And these impacts, we'll talk about this, I think, a little bit more, but they're going to affect port infrastructure, but also operations and the hinterland transport, as well as the broader global supply chain. That is, there's the potential for physical damage, but also significant disruption and delay, which brings with it extensive economic and trade-related losses. And we've seen some of this, for example, during the COVID pandemic, the cost of delay and disruptions. And that in turn has, again, important implications for sustainable development prospects, particularly of the most vulnerable nations. So we've been highlighting that climate change adaptation and resilient building for ports is of strategic economic importance, especially in the light of growing climate risks and of the cost of inaction. And maybe just to finish here, climate risk is a function of hazard exposure and vulnerability, which is the ability to cope. So if the hazards are growing, we must reduce our vulnerability, which means we need to take measures to adapt, and the hazards are growing.
Thank you very much for the really impactful introduction, Regina, on such a complicated subject. And I would like to go to Heather. How long does it usually take for a port to be built or upgraded together with the supporting infrastructure, because as Regina mentioned a minute ago, it's not only the port itself, it's road, rail, electricity, communications, etc. And if we can put it in quotation, how much the average port could cost?
Obviously, as you can imagine, it's not a one-size-fits-all answer. There's very much a difference between a cost of a port being built and one being upgraded. But not only is it ultimately very costly, but it's not a short process. So getting to construction itself can take many years. There's many different stages from the concept through to design, contractual requirements, before you even get to working on site, constructing a port or carrying out any upgrades to suit sea level changes. There's also a lot of work in the marine environment that we need to consider. There's the marine ecosystem and the effect the works will have on them during construction and afterwards. The construction itself, it does add another few years to that timeline, and more so if there are local considerations such as the adjacent socio-economic requirements. But ultimately, we are talking many years. It's not a quick fix. It's not something that happens in the space of less than a year. It's multi-million pounds, even if that is just upgrading an existing port, or, of course, many, many more million pounds if we are constructing a port from scratch. You did mention the supporting infrastructure, and that's very much how long is a piece of string. It does depend on the location, what exists already, what infrastructure you are putting the port adjacent to, and what needs to then be implemented to suit the type of port that is being constructed. So absolutely, there is a requirement to upgrade the supporting infrastructure, whether that's roads or rail or electricity or otherwise, but it's not something that we can put on paper a cost or a timeline associated to.
That would probably lead me to the next question that I have for Lydia, is like, with what we just heard, are the ports designed for climate resilience? So are they ready to tackle any floods or winds or any other future scenarios?
Well, thanks for the question. I mean, some years ago, when the ports were first designed, they had in mind the climate-related risks like floods and winds and also tides. And according to the hazards at that time, they were designed to face this hazard. But now the trouble is that the hazards related to climate are changing. We are in the process of climate change, and this means that the hazards related to floods, winds, and also tides, but also sea level rise are increasing. So the ports have not updated, at least not all of them, their resilience plans. And resilience is a double word. It includes two things. It's adaptation or mitigation of the risks, and also it includes recovery, which means when the risk happens and when you have damages because of those risks, then you need to be able to recover in a short time. So that's the future proofing includes both, includes adaptation, includes recovery. Resilience is this compound term. And we need always to remember that now we have the increased risk of future sea level rise, which will be the prime one hazard for ports.
But with what just Lydia mentioned here, what are the restrictions that the port are facing in this respect? Because she mentioned the double side, how we can bypass that kind of restrictions?
I think it's a really interesting point that Lydia makes. Many modern ports are designed and built with a much more informed knowledge of the impact of rising sea levels. And they're designed to either withstand or cope with this over the duration of design life. But of course, ports designed many years ago were done so on the same understanding, but actually that was the understanding at the time of climate resilience and its requirements. And it's actually something we're understanding more and more each year. Ultimately, though, the problem is with more and more resilience comes larger, maybe higher structures, more robust mooring equipment, deeper foundations, sea walls. And ultimately, all this leads to is more money. And so it's not to be assumed that all ports can become resilient. They will only be resilient to the degree that they can afford, perhaps, or that they can justify in their cost-benefit analysis of the trade that they have coming in. Because a decision will always need to be made on an individual basis, weighing that value of work that they will get from improving their resilience to the cost of those changes. But even so, while the structures are often designed to withstand the expected environmental loads and what we know right now for the duration of design life, what will often be a limiting factor is the ability for a vessel to even remain moored safely above certain wind speeds. So beyond certain conditions, there becomes at all times an economic loss or a safety concern if wind speeds exceed their allowable level. So it's not as easy to perhaps become resilient, use the term, against the wind speeds that we perhaps expect. There will always have to be a consideration of what operational restrictions you want to put in place against the change in environmental conditions. It's also not so straightforward as just increasing resilience and putting in restrictions. It depends on many factors of even the land adjacent, so socioeconomic factors, the marine environment, and what is actually feasible in that area.
I would like to go to Regina now. And, as we're discussing about those factors, which is kind of difficult to put a cost next to them, let's put it that way. I would like to ask you, which are the main climate and weather-related hazards, and what kind of impacts the ports are facing in order to tackle them?
Yes, thanks, Stavros. Important question, of course. There are many different types of hazards and impacts ports are facing. So, in terms of the hazards, there's of course mean sea level rise, but also extreme sea levels and increase in extreme sea levels, changes in wave energy and direction, precipitations or changes in the mean, but also in the intensity, type, and frequency of extremes that cause flooding, temperature higher. Mean temperatures, but also heat waves, and depending on the location of the ports, reduce Arctic snow cover and ice could be a problem, or permafrost degradation. And then there's wind. Heather just mentioned the increased wind speeds, for example, which is a particular problem for cranes. In terms of impacts, again, each of these has different types of impacts. So for the sea level for sea level rise, there's of course inundation risk, but also what I'd mentioned already earlier, increasing operational delays and disruptions. But we don't have the time really to go through all of these impacts. The point is they have to be assessed, the risks, and addressed. But to zoom in maybe on extreme sea levels, because of the location of ports, pose a particular risk of flooding and are a particular threat. They're projected to increase significantly under climate change. We did some research together with the Joint Research Centre of the European Commission, for example, and we found that even at 2 degrees warming, global warming, compared to pre-industrial levels, which is expected as soon as in the 2050s, so not that long in the future, given the lifespans, many ports in tropical and subtropical regions, including some of the top container ports, they could be exposed to extreme sea levels of a magnitude which in the past would be expected to occur once every 100 years, as often as every 1 to 10 years. And at 3 degrees, many global ports could experience these extreme sea levels several times per year. And another example concerns extreme heat, which drives up energy needs and costs in ports and also poses significant dangers to health and safety. At 2 degrees global warming, ports in most tropical and subtropical settings would face the baseline 1 in 100 years extreme heat event every 1 to 5 years. And at 3 degrees, most global ports, except some in the higher latitudes, could experience that what used to be a 1 in 100 year extreme heat event every 1 to 2 years. So you can see the hazards are increasing quite significantly, and that means there has to be action now to address this and build resilience against these future conditions. And as Heather mentioned, the project planning timelines mean that you really have to start about this early.
Thank you very much, Regina, for the response. And it's shocking the information you're providing to us because, as you said, everybody knows that we really have to plan for port infrastructure years in advance. And then the timeline that you provided is kind of feels like yesterday. But with that in mind, I would like to bring Heather. And Heather, do you think that most ports are climate resilient? And are they prepared to withstand to future climate hazards as the ones that Regina mentioned a minute ago?
Ultimately, and unfortunately, on a global level, no. I don't think it's unfair to say that there are certainly ports that have resilience against a set of defined hazards, but the hazards vary location by location, and also, therefore, the impact of preparing for them can range from small to large. The ability to withstand these hazards, therefore, not only varies by region, but as well as the operator and their defined future planning for what they want to do at their port. A large container terminal in the United Kingdom, constructed in the last decade, may be more likely to continue operations in most climates expected for that location when you compare it to an older multi-purpose terminal in an undeveloped country. But ultimately, with ever-evolving knowledge of the likely scenarios of the climate, very few ports are likely to be something you would consider climate resilient against what we know today for their design life.
Stavros, if I could
Yes.
just add something there, maybe.
Yes, please.
Obviously, this is completely correct what Heather has been pointing out. But just to mention, we did a few years ago, UNCTAD did a port industry survey, and actually, respondents represented 16% of the seaborne throughput, or accounted for 16% of global trade. So, of course, quite representative. And across regions and port sizes, one of the key insights from the responses was that ports are not yet adequately prepared. They feel they lack the information to act appropriately, even though they have all been affected increasingly by extreme events. And my understanding is that Pyang has carried out a similar survey, which goes in the, where the results go in the same direction. I think this is going to be published very soon. So, in a nutshell, at the global level, the answer definitely is that ports are not adequately prepared. And of course, in part, this is a capacity issue. Larger ports in industrialized countries will be better prepared. And some countries, like, let's say, the Netherlands or Japan, which face traditionally certain threats, they are more advanced, but certainly there is a long way to go to make sure that the ports, which are one way or the other interlinked, of course, across the globe, that they are adequately prepared to withstand future conditions.
And thank you very much for that note, Regina, which brings me also in mind that, it's like ports are always linked with some urban centers because we always need workers to go and work in there. And I would just like to ask Lydia, is like considering the fact that people are moving towards urban centers, which more and more of those urban centers are nearby the sea, and we see already 2/3 of the population will be leaving by 2050 by the coast, considering all that kind of level that we're discussing of increase of rise level of the water, all those people are going to be exposed to the overall phenomena we're discussing. Do you think that our societies are ready to tackle that kind of issues?
Well, thank you for the question because it's a complex one. We are talking about two different things. One is the total number of people that will be affected because they're moving to urban centers, which is one problem. And the second is the growth of each urban center. Let's start with the second because it's very important. Having a city, never mind if it's a port or any city, grows for say 2 million to 10 million, which is expected to many cities around the world in the next 30, 40 years. This increases the trouble and the problems for the infrastructure, for any infrastructure, not just the port, but also for the roads, for the water infrastructure, for the energy infrastructure, manifold. It's not just that doubling the number of, I don't know, wastewater treatment plants, not doubling the number of energy consumption. It's a manifold the increase. It's expands geometrically, and the complex design that will face the problems arising for these growing mega cities and mega ports is huge. It's unknown because climate change, which imposes new restrictions and new, I would say, hazards, is also unknown. There's a lot of uncertainty there. There's a lot of prime research being underway at the moment just to face the impact of urbanization to infrastructure. Now, if we think that the ports are also part of this urbanization and they need all the other infrastructures, water, wastewater, transport, energy, to operate, because without them, they cannot operate. We understand that this is a complex problem that faces many issues and needs a lot of cooperation to take it forward.
That cooperation and complex system you're describing leads me to the next question that goes to Heather. It's like, do you think we have any measures that we can take place in order to protect our infrastructure against extreme weather, like, for example, flash floodings that's taking place? Do we have any examples that we have managed to mitigate that kind of threats, or and we have managed to measure the impact they had?
The difficult thing when we talk about flooding is that when we consider resilience against sea level rise in a port, we consider operations, wave impacts, as well as flooding. But flooding is very difficult because generally ports like to have an open face to the sea and not a large flood wall hindering operations. So there certainly are some really brilliant examples of innovation and technology taken to protect against flash floods. But a lot of these examples don't necessarily relate directly to the larger commercial ports. We need to look to the Netherlands and other examples, such as the Venice Flood Barrier and the Thames Barrier, to see these. But quite often, unless a port sits within a waterway falling under a larger flood protection scheme, it perhaps would be inviable to protect a port alone from flooding, because the protection would need to actually encompass more than the seaward face, but actually the full perimeter to restrict inflow from adjacent land or hinterland. The best measure always will be, as Gina referenced, around actually informing those involved in the planning and operating the ports so an informed decision can be made on them.
Lydia, just thinking what you said a minute ago, what role can new technologies play, as for example, electrification or smart ports, and also nature-based solutions, in order to make ports more resilient to extreme weather events that we're discussing?
They certainly play an important role. Let's start with I would say the what people understand with new technologies in terms of IT and smart applications. The first aspect of this is that all the smart applications and the sensors and IT progress allows for better monitoring of the conditions, and also it allows to develop all sorts of models using also artificial intelligence, which will enable the to examine future scenarios and in better ways than in the past. But also it enables us to develop short-term forecasting for conditions and dangerous conditions that may come in the next few hours and prepare for them. And also send out alerts for the population, the port, to prepare for them. So this is what we expect from the IT. And this is the IT-related innovations and new technologies that are linked to the smart city and smart port applications. On the other hand, we need to go back to the old ways. We have developed a lot of hard technologies out of concrete and out of this type of materials in order to make the ports more easy to access and more safe. But now we need also to go back to nature-based solutions, which are softer at low technology. It's like making room for the river, as they say, for instance, in the Netherlands, but also in other types of soft interventions, which usually aim at preventing the flood, for instance, to create a big damage by retaining the flood at some natural places and control it in natural ways with enlarging, for instance, the area that they can retain. Where rainfall can be retained for a few hours instead of coming all of it together at the port. Apart from these, there are also nature-based solutions that will help in maintaining also other aspects of the ports and around the ports, which is referring to ecosystems and biodiversity. So we need to think in two ways. One, I would say the current AI, IT progress, and on the other hand, reverting to nature-based solutions, which will help also the port as an ecosystem, and not just the port itself, but the world around it, to better sustain these climate change hazards.
What you're describing is amazing because, we can probably use nature to help the problems that, that can probably pop in from nature. But I'm just thinking here, is it realistic from an engineer perspective for countries to invest in tackling the climate change related challenges that the ports will face?
Invest's a really great word, is it? It really is an investment when you consider the port utilization through different climates. But unfortunately, what a lot of this does come down to is cost. Whether that's the added cost of constructing a port to be resilient or the cost of upgrading an existing one, there are some really difficult conversations to be had specific to each port as to what the most appropriate solution and the extent to which they are taken is. Affordability, justification, they're two very big factors, but economic factors, including the change in seaborne traffic, future demands, they'll all pose a difficult question, an element to that equation. So ultimately, no, it is not realistic to expect it, but it is realistic to hope that the discussion is had and we continue to strive as an industry to improve technology, as Lydia's mentioned, the solutions that might be available. A country, well, perhaps more relative operators, they'll invest to suit their business requirements and risk approach. But funding is ultimately going to be the really big question that can override any desire that they may have in that.
And I'm just thinking, if developed countries, they cannot find the finance required to tackle that kind of issue. Regina, I know you have done an amazing amount of work with your colleagues in UNCTAD. Do you think that developing countries need more help, or can they tackle that issue?
Yes, I mean, you're basically already saying that there is a problem, and indeed there is. Developing countries, they are very often, if you think of the coastal developing countries or small island developing states, I mentioned they depend on ports and also coastal airports as veritable lifelines. So they are often very much exposed to these hazards. Many of, for example, the small island developing states are right in the middle of major storm tracks and they're facing increasing hazards. And at the same time, they're lacking capacity to respond. So that is a big problem. And what they need is targeted capacity building, both in terms of human resources and skills, for example, skilled coastal scientists and engineers at local levels to build adaptation and resilience in the future, but also mainstreaming of this into ordinary transport planning operations and management and into nationally determined contributions and national adaptation plans under the Paris Agreement. But as concerns the particular needs of developing countries, often at the front line of impacts with low adaptive capacity and also worsening debt crisis, there's a big need for better availability and access to infrastructure adaptation finance, including in the form of grants rather than loans. We've done a policy brief on this type of issue not long ago. And just to give you an example, estimated adaptation costs in developing countries, it's not just for ports, of course, are 10 to 18 times greater than current public adaptation finance flows. So if you look at just figures from OECD, the latest figures suggest that in 2020, total climate finance provided and mobilized by developed countries for developing countries were just about 83 billion US dollars, over 70% of which in the form of loans. And of this total, only 28.6 billion was for adaptation. Only a fraction of this, of course, amount will have been targeting climate change adaptation for ports and other critical transport infrastructure. So you can see what great need there is for upscaling adaptation finance, both in terms of accessibility and affordability.
And that makes absolutely sense. And I like the fact that you managed to bring some of the actual cost elements on board because, as we have issues related to the weather, for example, Mississippi River has been experienced big droughts back in 2022 that led to 20 billion of losses. Panama Canal, as we know at the moment, that is responsible for transporting 40% of the US containers, has dropped by 3 meters the level of water. And of course, that is impacting not only the maritime sector, but is impacting the overall supply chain. Do you think, Regina, that we may need to invest even further on redesigning our supply chains that will be able to cope with that kind of extreme weather scenarios? Because from what we have seen already, we had the Red Sea crisis, for example, and instantly everybody says that our supply chains need to be redesigned completely. Do we have to consider the extreme weather scenarios on board? And some reports, as you mentioned earlier on, they're talking about some ports need to invest up to 10 billion on that. Some of the ports will be maybe unusable by 2050 if the rising of sea levels goes on. How that's going to be the implication of the overall port supply chain sector And what's the cost of inaction?
Yes, this is a very important question. I mean, in a nutshell, I think it's important to understand the cost of inaction far outweighs the cost of action. So obviously, it's going to cost something to prepare, but not necessarily in all cases capital invest intensive infrastructure costs. Could also be design changes. But if you do nothing, then the cost of inaction can be absolutely devastating. And there are some data. You mentioned one report, and it's actually quite aptly called Act Now or Pay Later, the costs of climate inaction for ports and shipping, which was highlighting some of the costs in that could arise in future. And there are other studies which emphasize the port-specific risk from natural hazards or the systemic risk to supply chains. And the figures here are annual figures, in many cases, not necessarily taking into account climate change in the future, but just current risk. But even something like a figure of 10 billion annually, which is not little, but even that is probably an underestimate, because if you just consider that individual single events can have much larger economic costs. To take an example, Hurricane Sandy, which hit New York City in 2012, that caused over 62 billion losses in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, including extensive damage and a week-long shutdown of one of the major US container ports, the New York, New Jersey container port. And other studies tell us, for example, the port of Busan was inoperable for 91 days by Typhoon Mamie. So the cost of operational disruption and delays is significant. You mentioned the Panama Canal, which is affected by severe drought. And as part of one of the consequences of that is that there is enormous delay. And the Panama Canal Authority is auctioning off slots. And the cost of these slots has shot up. And I read in December the average cost for a slot was over $1 million, which was more than 10 times what it was before. And I think the record was $4 million for crossing. So you can, I mean, it's just once you start getting into the, once you zoom into the possible economic losses throughout the supply chain, the knock-on effects, that is really when you realize unless we ensure the functional integrity of ports and of other critical transport links, we may face a situation where the costs and the losses that are arising, they are not insurable. It's not a matter of who pays, but they're not anymore insurable, and they're going to seriously affect our global trade and development prospects.
Lydia, I'm just thinking, do you have any views on that, on the cost of inaction, and how could ports better plan and prepare for the unpredictable future? Because we're talking here for probably more collaboration could be a solution between ports and shipping companies, logistics providers, and how that collaboration could promote and support flood-resistant infrastructure.
First thing we need to understand is that we are talking for a very complicated situation, which becomes even more complicated by what the climate projections or the climate experts call tipping points. We are heading to new tipping points, which have to do with the circulation of water in the oceans and the climate change. And this will lead to new equilibrium between in as us conditions, not just for the ports, but for everything. And for this new equilibrium and these new uncertainties, we don't know what will happen. It will affect everything, the infrastructures, the transport, the trade, but also socio-economic conditions. To face this complex situation, we need collaboration. Unfortunately, until recently, the experts work in silos. We have the water experts and the transport experts and the port experts and the energy experts, and everyone is working in their own domain, more or less individually, I would say on a vertical basis. If we want to face the future with all these uncertainties as a global phenomenon which affects everything, we need to collaborate. The disciplinary, single disciplinary research is not enough. We need to have interdisciplinary research, but also we need to have interdisciplinary governance. One of the things we see is that we have one authority that deciding on one thing, for instance, the water infrastructure, and then we have another authority deciding about the transport infrastructure and what needs to be done, and the third authority deciding about the energy infrastructure. If these authorities don't collaborate, don't make decisions that will encompass everything, we cannot see a way forward. So I'm a firm believer in collaboration. I'm a firm believer also in interdisciplinary collaboration. And this, as I said, needs changes in the science, the research, but also in governance, in the way also that the governments behave. You cannot make an investment in one sector without thinking of the impacts in the other sector, which is interlinked. And you cannot also decide on an investment without consulting the other sectors, which are interlinked. Everything operates as a nexus with cascading effects affecting one or the other. Unless we understand these cascading effects and these cascading impacts of our decisions, unless we collaborate across sectors, I don't see how we can effectively be resilient as ports for the future.
And Regina, as you have kind of a better view than anybody else, are there any countries or organizations working on that scenario that Lydia just mentioned?
Yes, just to say, Lydia is absolutely right. You need extensive collaboration, interdisciplinary collaboration, and mainstreaming. I've mentioned this before, and also systems thinking. So understanding that nothing operates in isolation. So ports are obviously part of larger port cities. They're integrated in urban agglomerations. There's hinterland transport links, and all the stakeholders and all the authorities that are involved in that need to be brought together. So in terms of what's been happening on that, there is a big need, of course, for technical guidance and standards, and we have had some progress there. For example, the International Standardization Organization, ISO, has developed some standards to help organizations with adaptation planning, and that includes ports. Technical guidance has been issued by PIANC and, very importantly, also by the European Commission. And that is actually technical guidance that needs to be applied as part of climate proofing of new infrastructure in the future for port infrastructure projects, either in the European Union or financed by the European Union outside the EU. And there are methodological tools. So we developed a methodology, for example, as part of a project focusing on developing small island developing states in 2018 that is transferable. There are others, for example, there's a research project in the EU Eclipse, which has developed a methodology and so on. So there is some development in terms of guidance. Also, the Marrakesh Partnership for Global Climate Action, which is the UNFCCC forum for non-state actors, so anybody who isn't a state, that is industry, organizations, and so on, they have developed some recommendations as part of a climate action pathway for transport on resilience building. But all of this isn't really enough. And Lydia mentioned the importance of governance. So what does governance mean? I mean, this is in essence, this is policy and legal frameworks. And again, policy, there have been enormous advances recently, but policies can only go so far. They define and specify agreed commitments, but legal frameworks are very important to translate that into action on the ground to implement these commitments. And in that context, I think it's important to mention the developments at the EU level in terms of legal developments, particularly. The European Union adopted a regulation on a climate law in 2021, and that is directly applicable and effective in all 27 EU member states, which, among others, includes obligations regarding efforts towards adaptation. And they've supplemented that with technical guidance on climate proofing of infrastructure. I already mentioned this briefly. This has to be taken into consideration as part of environmental impact assessments. And under a proposed regulation for the TEN-T network, that's the Trans-European Network for Transport, that's sort of the main motorways for transport, the arteries throughout the EU. Under a proposed regulation, this technical guidance on climate proofing would also be required to be considered in the construction of all new TEN-T infrastructures. So this is a very important development in the EU, is expected to increase levels of preparedness there, but also could provide an important impetus for policymakers in other countries, this relation between policy, law, and then technical guidance. So a lot more needs to be done in this respect, but there are some encouraging signs. But the progress altogether is not quite as fast as one as is really needed. And that is a bit of a concern.
Thank you very much, Regina. And with that concern, probably I'll go to Heather and ask, okay, we don't have the framework, and as Regina just mentioned, but do you think we can create that infrastructure to deal with that holistic issue that was mentioned both from Regina and Lydia earlier on? And if not, how long it's going to take us to build it, and how easy is to do that thing?
It's a really interesting question. And it is indeed about collaboration. We only need to look at coast engineering to know you can't protect one stretch of a coastline and think there won't be an effect elsewhere or ingress from adjacent areas. It does sometimes link back to Lydia's comment around how we can prepare. So Regina mentioned Hurricane Sandy. That's a really good example of a climate that you would actually really struggle to put in place infrastructure to handle. But if we concentrate on just rising seawater and sea levels, of course, there is a difference between protection and the ability to withstand from an operational perspective, such as pavements able to withstand being flooded, smart technology, such as means of mooring and berthing without personnel. But to go back to your question, unless it was designed for it in the first place, the infrastructure isn't there. The knowledge is there to carry out amendments to existing structures to deal with rising sea levels, but there may not always be the space, or as I mentioned earlier, even the desire to do so if it does impact on operations by having those structures there. So ports can, of course, consider their reaction and their response to flooding to protect their terminal. But if it's desired, we go back to the original point that this is not a quick fix. We have the technologies, we have the knowledge that we can implement, but the implementation can take anything from a very short amount of time for a small flood wall to many, many years for a more significant infrastructure upgrade. After all, the rising sea levels don't just affect water ingress. They change the level of the vessel in relation to mooring equipment. That changes the line angles and the loads on the structure and even the mechanical handling operations. So this isn't really a small fix, and it isn't just about sea level rise or the collaboration. It's also about the desire of the operator and the cost associated with it.
Thank you very much. And I'm just thinking that we're just scratching the surface here of a huge problem that we're going to face quite soon from what was already discussed. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to elaborate any further, but I would like to ask the same question to all three of you. And I would like to ask, Heather, let's start with you. Any further thoughts that you may have on how ports and terminals could adapt to the new challenges posed by the climate change?
I think you're right, there's a lot of challenges. And I don't think, whilst I've been quite lucid defining costs and programmes, I think it's a saying that we can't define how an operator or a country might respond. It can't be automatic. It comes down to drive, desire and money. But ports have long lifespans, which means there's a difference between adaptations to those built and adaptations to those going forward. And there's a cost associated with implementing these. So for me, the most important thing really would be understanding the risks now and implementing them in a timely manner and informing those of the risks.
Thank you very much for that. Regina?
Yes. Now, I think one of the big messages that has to come across is that physical climate risks for ports translate into business risks. And past experience no longer provides a good indication of future risks. So with the hazards growing, effective risk and vulnerability assessments at facility levels are becoming increasingly important to prepare for future conditions. So this is something which is really important to understand, that to be able to adapt and build resilience effectively, we need to improve the understanding on the impacts on a particular port to guide effective adaptation responses and prioritize resources, and also to avoid maladaptation, because it's no good to just say, let's build a wall here. That can exacerbate actually the problem unless you understand how the particular conditions are in that port. So you need facility level risk and vulnerability assessments, improved data collection and availability, and early planning. Heather mentioned the long lifespans, planning horizons and lifespans. I had mentioned earlier the importance of a systems approach and of mainstreaming, and I cannot highlight this enough, mainstreaming into these types of considerations into ordinary port infrastructure planning and operations, just like other risks, so that there is an ongoing assessment, basically, of what the changing conditions may bring. And of course, we had mentioned also earlier that there is a need for increased capacity building, particularly, of course, for the developing countries. But for example, as far as education and training for coastal scientists, engineers and so on is concerned, there is a big gap in all countries. And, you know, more effort has to be paid into getting this right. So by way of a final comment, I would really say this is something where we need all hands on deck and time is of the essence.
Thank you very much, Regina. And Lydia, definitely not the least, but I really want to hear your comment on that.
Well, I think Regina made a very nice conclusion. I would like also to elaborate a little more on what she said. One word, maladaptation. This is a new word. It didn't exist a few years ago. It's now coming mainstream, and it means that we are also examining wrong decisions. Decisions that mean with good intentions that may lead to adverse results in the future. And this is something we need to be very careful. And it is a new area of research. I would like again to go back to the cooperation. I would like to have to stress how important it is not to divide the research or the applications or the investments to what happens inshore, inland, to what happens in the ocean and the coastal zones. That's very important because it's one system, it's not two systems. Until recently, for instance, the Commission had different funding and different research groups and different research calls for ocean and maritime water and inland water. Only recently, they started having common calls. As a result, now they even in the standards, they can bring, for instance, for the IT technologies, the digital twins to the same standards. This has not happened, but it's happening. And again, we go back to collaboration. It's a system. It's not one thing. We need the cooperation of the scientists, the cooperation of the engineers. We need also the cooperation of the authorities, the governance, which is very important, so as not to arrive to maladaptation and to be able to face the complex problems of the future, which are coming.
Thank you very much, Lydia. And with that note, as the three of you just mentioned, I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. It's a very complicated problem that we really have to take action as soon as possible. But unfortunately, we have to conclude here. It's been great to discuss such a hot and urgent topic as the challenges and opportunities relate to the rising of sea levels and port infrastructure with you, Lydia, Heather, and Regina. And many thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Stavros.
Thank you very much, Stavros. It's been very interesting, and I hope the listeners have found it of interest.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thanks to you for listening to Navigating Marine Risks, produced in partnership with AIG. I hope we've provided some valuable insights into a crucial issue for shipping, a sector that is responsible for the transportation of 80% of anything that we consume daily. From me, Dr. Stavros Karamberidis, goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of American International Group Incorporated or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by our speakers are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series and will not be liable for any errors, omissions, or delays in this information or any losses, injuries, or damages arising from its use.